from the City of Angels near the Pacific Ocean. Good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, the witching herbs. Oh, boy. Wait for that one. Here's what's happening. Winter's still here, at least up there in the Northeast. A late-season nor'easter lashed the region Tuesday with sleet and more than 2 feet of snow in some places, paralyzing much of the Washington to Boston corridor, grounding more than 5,900 flights. The sloppy storm with high winds knocked out power to more than 100,000 customers from Virginia to Pennsylvania, closing schools in cities big and small, and prompting warnings from officials to stay off the roads. Philadelphia and New York City escaped the brunt of the snow, getting just a few inches and not the foot or more the forecasters had expected before the storm switched over mostly to sleet. Yep, winter's still here. A growing U.S. presence off the Korean Peninsula, which includes drone stations, military drills, and even elite American special forces, reportedly part of a plan aimed at incapacitating the rogue regime in North Korea should conflict break out. On Sunday, the U.S. declared it will permanently station unmanned missiles capable drones in South Korea. The development came amid reports that elite U.S. forces, possibly including SEAL Team 6, will take part in joint military drills with South Korea. Meanwhile, Kim Jong-un has threatened to unleash what he calls a merciless attack on America if joint military exercises with South Korea continue. He said he would attack his Western enemies from the ground, air, sea, and underwater in a saber-rattling statement released through the state media. Dr. Jerome Corsi from Infowars.com with us and author of a number of books. Jerry, this is getting a little more tense, isn't it?
Much more tense, George. I think these escalations are going to create a situation that could break out into war at any time. I mean, with these drones, the Gray Eagle drones, and they're capable of carrying Hellfire missiles, and that with the the THAAD anti-ballistic missile defenses and now in South Korea, is quite a buildup of U.S. military power under President Trump. And this could be one of the first real tests of President Trump's military strategies. And I'd recommend that North Korea think twice before defying President Trump.
What do you think his generals, Kim Jong-un's generals, are thinking right now?
Well, I think they must think he's a little bit insane. I mean, somehow or other, this idea of saber rattling and firing missiles into the Sea of Japan is just provocative, and I don't know where it's going to be headed other than a confrontation. And China does not seem to be able to control North Korea any longer, or at least not to the extent it used to. North Korea is getting more belligerent and developing ballistic missiles now. They have a nuclear warhead. So, this is just headed on a path which looks to me like a military confrontation is inevitable.
I think so, too. Can North Korea's nuke-tipped missiles reach Hawaii, Jerry?
Probably not today. I don't think their ballistic missiles are yet quite capable, but they're advancing very quickly. They're going to be able to reach Hawaii. That's the problem, is that we just keep putting this off with North Korea, and eventually they're going to be seriously capable of reaching Hawaii. They're capable now of reaching Japan. How accurate their missiles are, how much damage they could really do, is yet not certain. But I don't think we want to take the chance to find out.
Well, and all he's got to do is pack it up on some kind of launcher on some freighter and bring it along shore of, let's say, Los Angeles.
That's or exploded in the high altitude.
EMP attack.
An EMP attack. So these are the kinds of things I think that U.S. military has to be watching very carefully. And the U.S. military, I think, is going to be very different under President Trump than it was under President Obama. I really don't recommend North Korea push Donald Trump too hard.
Jerry Corsi, the Washington correspondent for Infowars.com. Germany's justice minister is proposing fines of up to $53 million for social networking sites that fail to swiftly remove illegal content such as hate speech or defamatory fake news. The plan announced Tuesday marks a further step in Germany's attempt to impose a strict domestic law against incitement on the freewheeling world of online chatter. In Oklahoma City, they may miss an hour of sleep up there when we turned our clocks, but chances are the kids don't know that. Why? A new study shows that 1 in 10 Oklahoma City kids ages 6 to 12 who own a watch, only 1 in 5 know how to read it. Folks, the world has gone digital. People look at their phones for the time. Kids don't know how to read watches. Most kids don't even know how to subtract or add anymore because of the use of handheld computers and things like that, and calculators. Roseville, Minnesota has become the first city in the state to ban the commercial sale of dogs and cats at pet stores. The city council began discussions to prohibit sales last year after a pet store in the city that sold dogs and cats received a troubling inspection from the U.S. Department of Agriculture. We may have seen the worst of the current flu season. According to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the numbers have been elevated for 12 straight weeks, but health officials are starting to notice a downturn. Currently, 39 states reporting widespread flu activity, down slightly from the 43 a week before. Let's check in with Dr. Gary Ridenour, expert on the pandemic. Gary, this situation here, is it finally waning for the season?
I think it may be. One of our biggest problems is that we really didn't get much report on what the flu vaccine did this year. And also, the CDC put out 8 kinds of flu vaccines that you could pick from. One of our biggest problems and why people are so sick is our healthcare system is like flying in mushroom soup. You know, all the doctors that were in private practice have been forced into working for the hospital system and the man. I know of a woman who's got Obamacare. She has 3 kids. Her deductible is $12,000. So you're not going to go to the emergency room because you can't afford $1,500 for that visit. And it's even worse for Medicare and Medicaid. You go to the emergency room, and they treat you like you're a 1920 sharecropper because you have crappy insurance. So there's a lot of sick people that are just staying home or going to work and spreading it around.
Got to get that fixed. Thanks, Gary. Dr. Gary Ridenour, the flu starting to wane, still out there. In a moment, Michael Osterholm joins us. His latest work, Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs That Seem to Be Everywhere. He's our guest next on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast. George Norrie with you and our special guest, Dr. Michael Osterholm. He is the Regents Professor, McKnight Presidential Endowed Chair in Public Health, and the founding director of the Center for Infectious Disease Research at the University of Minnesota. An internationally renowned epidemiologist, he's been at the forefront of public health preparedness, has led many outbreak investigations of international importance, advises world leaders on the ever-growing list of microbial threats, and they are out there. Michael, welcome to the program. So much to talk with you about tonight. Good to have you.
Very good to be here.
And you're out in New York. Are you
I am.
Bombarded by the snow? Did you get in okay?
I actually left Minneapolis, fortunately, on Monday and arrived before the storm. And yesterday, as I think you've heard, the snowfall really moved westward, inland more than it did New York City. So we only got 6 to 7 inches here, although the wind last night was quite remarkable. So it was good to get here, and the city is quickly recovering.
Well, I lived in Minnesota back around 78 to 79, worked at KSTP Television, and in those days, those winters were cold, Michael.
Yes, that's true. We actually know how to survive winter in Minnesota. As you know, our airport is one where, you know, unless you have a very, very significant blizzard, it tends to operate quite well. So it does matter where you are traveling to or traveling from today in terms of weather.
Does the cold wipe out infectious diseases or increase it?
Well, actually, it varies. It depends on which diseases you're talking about and for why. For example, if you take the obvious one, mosquito-borne diseases in the Americas, and even based on sunlight length in the semi-tropical regions, will actually be greatly depressed during the winter time or even dry, cold season for the semi-tropic areas. On the other hand, when you bring people together and put them in closed spaces, And along with the drop in relative humidity, which actually in some cases makes aerosols, that very fine mist that comes out of your mouth and your nose when you breathe, actually enhanced under dried conditions. And then we see the increased transmission of diseases like influenza and others during the winter and cold months. So that it just varies which diseases you're talking about.
Why can't we kill viruses with antibiotics? Why won't they die?
Well, that's a very important point, and in a sense the question is, you have to have the exact drug that kills that agent. So we actually do have antiviral drugs. In many cases, we don't kill the agent right away, meaning the virus with an antiviral. But for example, there's a drug for influenza, which is actually quite effective in reducing the seriousness and the length of time you carry it. We have drugs that we treat people with who have certain kinds of other viral infections, shingles. The chickenpox virus, we can treat them once they get shingles. For hepatitis, we actually have drugs today that can, one type of hepatitis, hepatitis C, which is a very important problem in the baby boomer generation, actually will completely cure you from hepatitis C, the virus in your liver. So we do have drugs for viruses. But when you asked about antibiotics, which is the common used products for bacteria, they do not have any impact on viruses. And that's where we encourage physicians today not to use antibiotics such as the common penicillin and tetracycline and so forth on non-bacterial infections because it will be of no use. And that's why we're concerned because of the fact that with the use of those antibiotics, when they're not necessary, you actually encourage antibiotic resistance to develop in other bacteria in that same environment or in that person.
Your book, Deadliest Enemy, Our War Against Killer Germs, just came out. How does that differ from some of the other infectious disease books like Hot Zone or Spillover?
Well, you know, I'm reminded by the fact here that your predecessor, Art Bell, had me on actually in 2000. Talking about, at that time, the potential for bioterrorism.
And of course, that was Living Terrors, that book, right?
Exactly. That book actually was ironically published on 9/11 of 2000, 1 year to the day before 9/11. And I was on this show, and I have to say I was very impressed with the audience you had at that time.
Oh, it's amazing.
It's an amazing audience. And it was interesting because at that time, it was just about bioterrorism, and there's been a whole series of books that have come out about public health challenges or problems. But more often than not, what the books really are about is just storytelling about the problem. And I've been in the business now for 40-some years, and what we need is a plan. We need something beyond what we currently have. And so this book really lays out, number one, what are the underlying reasons for why we have the problems today? So in Deadliest Enemy, we give you the data why in 2017 the risks for infectious diseases globally are higher today than they've been any time in human history. Number two is we then define what those problems are. We give you some ordered measure of saying the most significant problems are pandemic influenza and antibiotic resistance. And then we go on and say, oh, man, what are we going to do about it? And that's the part I think that's been largely missing in most of these books and many of these reports is what are we going to do about it? And so we hope that from this, someone can actually take the information and make a case for why it's important and then know what to do about it.
Michael, we've witnessed things like the CDC talking about SARS, saying it's going to be an epidemic, run for the hills, and then nothing really happens. As a matter of fact, the death rate from some of those diseases dramatically less than what the common flu gets every year. How do they miss that?
Well, it's not so much that they miss it. I think it's all about what we call, I guess, basic good public relations and communications. For example, we heard a lot about the Ebola situation in West Africa. And two really important messages that were missed in that situation is the same problem was never going to occur in America because the way Ebola virus is transmitted by this close personal contact, body fluid sharing, taking care of patients in a very crude healthcare setting where you yourself are not protected, that's how transmission was going to continue. That was never going to happen in the United States. We could have isolated cases here, but the United States responded in large part as if this is going to happen here too. The second part about Ebola that we didn't really talk about was that during the same time that people were dying of Ebola in West Africa, which was a very serious challenge, more people actually died from not receiving their vaccines for childhood immunizations, for diarrheal disease, and for malaria. And so what often really kills us versus what hurts us versus what concerns us versus what scares us are often different depending on where you sit and how the media is covering it. And what happened with the CDC in some of these situations, they do project forward, this is what could happen. You gave the example of SARS. This is a virus basically causing a very serious disease back in 2003 and 4 in China. It was a respiratory transmitted virus. It virtually shut down Toronto for a better part of 12 weeks.
Did it come from chickens, if I remember?
No, actually, it had a more interesting route, you might say. That's influenza. This actually is a virus that's native in bats. And in this case, the bats actually had a spillover into several food rodents, badger dogs and palm civets that were sold in the markets of the Guangdong province. And when people came in contact with those animals, they picked it up from them. But the note here is that it did cause really severe problems in places like Toronto, Vancouver, where the virus moved because people traveled. The same thing happened with the MERS virus, a similar virus, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome virus, where about 30% of people die like they did with SARS. And that was a virus in which an outbreak that I was very actively involved with was when an ill individual from the Middle East took that virus back to Seoul, Korea, and brought it into Samsung Medical Center. At that time, that one of the people who got infected transmitted to another 80 people in the emergency room in one morning and virtually shut down the Samsung Medical Center, which is one of the most modern medical facilities in the world, just like the Mayo Clinic or the Cleveland Clinic or Johns Hopkins. And so that's what we were warning against, is these isolated events could occur, but they weren't isolated in the sense that where they happened, they were very tragic. And so that's the challenge, is it's not going to happen everywhere, but where it did happen, it could be really a serious problem.
Does it take just one infected person?
It does. It takes just one, depending on what the particular agent is. For taking MERS and SARS as the example we just talked about, and we talk about this at great length in Deadliest Enemy, what makes a disease important to the public's health? And it's how well is it transmitted? If you and I, for example, have HIV, we can work in a workplace setting safely. We can have contact with our loved ones and hold them and so forth. It's the transmission through sexual contact that is really that, or a blood transfusion from that individual, that's concerned. Well, if you have a respiratory transmitted agent, you and I are breathing. Influenza is a good example of that. And when that happens, actually, you can just be in the same room with me and share the same air with me, and now you can become infected. So what we're really concerned about are those agents that are infectious diseases that are most likely transmitted via the respiratory route, meaning you just have to breathe, and that's all you have to do. And that's what helps us understand what are the most important infectious diseases we need to deal with, because it's the ones that can travel around the world overnight that we really have to be concerned about, and those are the ones transmitted via the respiratory route.
And you say in Deadliest Enemy that we are at a point where global infectious disease crises could be at the greatest risk of any time in human history. Is that because of technology, traveling, planes, and things like that?
Well, it's a combination of factors. To use an overused term often, it's a perfect storm. First of all, remember that today we have about 7.6 billion people on the face of the earth. One out of every eight people who's ever lived is on the face of the earth right now. And if you look where the greatest growth around the world is, it's in the megacities of the developing world. So, for example, why should we have been surprised about why Ebola virus, which was a spillover event again from bats, we think that's where the virus is at, got into subhuman primates, monkeys, the great apes, and so forth, and then often humans come in contact with that, and then the outbreaks start by just having the body fluid contact. But when those outbreaks were occurring in very rural villages of Africa, sometimes 2 to 3 days walk from the nearest road, that was going to quickly burn out, meaning that, you know, only so many people could have contact with another case in that village, and it was going to end. But then suddenly, when you started seeing these megacities develop, take Kinshasa today in the Democratic Republic of the Congo, a city of 14 million people, 6 million people living in the most dire settings you could imagine in the slums of Kinshasa. There, when a virus gets into that, it's like hitting dry tinder. It just flashes and goes through that entire population. So there are many examples today around the world where infectious diseases have this ability to flash and to consume a large number of people quickly, and we talk about that in Deadliest Enemy. The second thing is we move everything around the world today. We've eliminated oceans, mountain ranges, country borders, anything as a boundary for infection.
Right, everything is close. Michael, hold on. We're going to take a break. We're going to come back and talk about deadliest enemy, our war against killer germs. And welcome back to Coast, Deadliest Enemy. That's the work of Michael Osterholm as we're talking about our war against killer germs. When you talk about killer germs, Michael, are we talking about things that people will get in the bathroom when you're leaving, touching the handle of the door, going down an escalator at a supermarket or a mall or something like that?
No, actually, those are clearly ways that some infectious agents can be transmitted, some bacteria in particular, some viruses, but really a very limited number that we worry about. What we're talking about here are the kind of diseases that more often are transmitted via the respiratory route, or just breathing in the air, you breathing and blowing the virus or the bacteria out, and then in turn, you breathing it in. And that's where we see many of the most serious agents. Now, we do have to say that there is at least some of the antibiotic-resistant infections that are picked up, but they're in hospital settings largely, where we use lots of antibiotics, and they're in the environment. Some cases are diseases that can be transmitted just by having contact in that hospital room where the previous patient was treated with antibiotics and left behind their antibiotic-resistant bacteria on the walls and on the phones and so forth and weren't adequately cleaned. But otherwise, it's really about breathing the air that's the biggest one. Or, and of course, around the world with HIV and so forth, sexual transmission is another very significant means of transmission. And then finally, the mosquitoes and ticks and how they carry diseases are the other one.
Strange question, but are these viruses intelligent? Do they know what they're doing?
Well, they're not intelligent in the sense that they think about what they're doing, but they're very intelligent in the sense that they're driven by one very overriding principle, and that's called evolution. And so how they've survived over all of the eons of time really has had to do with the fact that evolution basically created these strains by subjecting them to the kind of pressures in the environment that would normally kill them if they mutated the wrong way, so that they couldn't reproduce appropriately, or they couldn't infect certain other animal species or even humans, then they would die off. And so evolution has been finely tuning, you might say, these infectious agents since the beginning of time. And that's what really drives them.
But they're alive, right?
Well, some are and some are not. If we go back to the most basic of infectious agents, or something that can cause infectious diseases, are a kind of piece of chemical structure called a prion, which is what causes mad cow disease in Europe and particularly in England. It's what causes the diseases now in certain wildlife here in the United States, white-tailed deer, elk, and so forth. And it can cause a disease in sheep called scrapie. So those are the really most basic ones. And that's just a piece of genetic material that gets transmitted from one infected individual to someone else. Viruses themselves cannot survive unless they have the cells of a living creature to actually grow in, and then take over the machinery of that cell, reproduce itself, and then kick itself out. As you only get higher in the order to the bacteria families, you actually find free-ranging agents that can do quite well in the environment by themselves, and then, of course, parasites the same way.
Michael, I do not get the flu vaccine. I haven't had the flu in God knows how long, knock on wood. Got to find that around here in the studio. I do not tell people to get it or not to get it. I simply tell them what I do. And what is the latest with flu vaccines? Because I have talked to some people who have gotten the vaccine, and it didn't help them. If anything, it hurt them.
Well, the current flu vaccines that we use are really the remnants of the 1940s and 50s research on flu vaccine. And while they're quite safe, they don't always work that well. And we in the public health community really have to make that case loud and clear, because it's really impeding us from getting new and better flu vaccines. People think what we have works well enough. We've made a major push in the United States, and some other countries around the world have had somewhat similar approaches. Well, we want to get everybody vaccinated because seasonal flu is a serious disease. Anywhere from 3 to 49, 50,000 people a year die from influenza in the United States. Most years it's on the lower end of that scale, but it surely is a disease that is of concern. Flu vaccines vary by which of the flu viruses are floating around out there. They're going to cause human infection. There's one type, H3N2, that it is more often a more severe disease in the older population. There's another one, H1N1, that is one that's often more of a problem actually in the younger population. And depending on which one's floating around, the vaccine may work sometimes 50% of the time, sometimes in your age group it doesn't work at all, and sometimes it may work closer to 70-80%. So our message is that right now the flu vaccine is the best hope you have of preventing influenza, but we surely do need new and better flu vaccines, and that's at the heart of what we talk about in Deadliest Enemy, is that today the number one disease threat to the world, to really disrupt the world as we know it, is another serious 1918-like influenza pandemic, where the flu virus emerges out of wild birds, genetically changes through mutation, or what we call reassortment, where it mixes with another flu virus, and then infects humans for the first time, and they then in turn can transmit to others. That type of influenza pandemic could be devastating. Over 250 million people died in the world in 1918, and with today's population, that could be many times that number if another virus like that showed up. So from a flu vaccine standpoint, we want new and better flu vaccines that are more effective, that can be given once and maybe last for 5 or 10 years and protect against many strains of flu. That would be a real gift to the global health issue.
We're with Michael Osterholm as we're talking about the Deadliest Enemy. Michael, there are a lot of people, when you talk about the things like the flu, of course, they have mixed feelings about it. They have mixed feelings about Big Pharma. Lots of people don't trust Big Pharma. They think all they want to do is sell vaccines, whether they're effective or not. How do you combat that?
Well, that really is absolutely complete misinformation. I think that I've made my career over the last 40-some years of telling the truth. And whether it's something that the public health community doesn't want to hear, or whether it's the general public doesn't want to hear, and that's, again, we highlight in Deadliest Enemies, what should you believe and not believe and why.
Mm-hmm.
When you look at today's vaccine world, it is such a small part of the pharmaceutical industry, just a few percent. I mean, we have blockbuster drugs out there right now, including the lifestyle drugs, erectile dysfunction drugs that make much, 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 much more money than vaccines could ever make. And so today, we actually need the pharmaceutical industry to make these vaccines that then are overseen by governments around the world in the safety features, whether it's in this country, the Food and Drug Administration, in Europe, there's the EMA, the European Medical Agency, and these go through rigorous testing and safety issues. And so the idea that these rumors that come up, the one that has been most devastating has been that with measles vaccine and autism, which was totally a sham. I mean, this was made up information by a physician who has now lost his medical license. The paper's been withdrawn, and yet the rumors continue on. There is simply no evidence whatsoever that the measles vaccine causes autism. And meanwhile, measles is a very serious disease. People die from it. Prior to the advent of using vaccines in children, many thousands of children died each year in this country from these types of diseases, and around the world they still do, or we can't get vaccines to the population. So, my answer to this is, if there really is a serious issue with the vaccine, there are many of us in the public health community that speak up immediately. And others out there who say that they are not safe, ask them what their real data are, what their training is, and you'll see that this is really just fear-mongering, and it's fear-mongering at a cost.
Does that upset you when you hear that?
Pardon?
Does that upset you when you hear that from some people, including some doctors?
You deal with this on the air here.
All the time.
I love the way you handle your show in terms of just trying to get at the truth. It's not to argue. You just go after the truth, and I respect that so much. I do the same in my business. I surely take on issues, but, we want the truth, and we want the public to be informed. And I think that part of it is, and there are probably a number of listeners on this show who can identify with this, the older I get, and now I have children and grandchildren, I don't translate things today one-to-one for me, but I translate them a lot for my kids and grandkids. What does this mean for them? And it's a very high standard, much higher than I would set for myself. And so when we look at public health issues, and that's what we tried to do in the book Deadliest Enemies, is really lay out what are the things that are going to impact our children and grandchildren's future. Antibiotic resistance is one of them. There's another flu pandemic coming. There's no doubt about it. The pandemic clock is ticking. We just don't know what time it is. The kinds of problems like that that we can do something about, and that's how we look at it through the lens of our kids and grandkids, and what does it mean to them?
Just a few weeks ago, the half-brother of the North Korean dictator, he was killed at an airport in Malaysia. And a couple of women sprayed something on him, touched him with something. What was that? Was that some kind of bioterrorism threat or some kind of chemical? What do you think happened to him?
Well, at this point, you know, I'm a citizen in this case, okay, as much consulting as I do with the government and for the government and other governments around the world on these issues, you know, we have to go with what we've gotten in the media about that. And surely it did look very much like one of several different kinds of chemicals that we worry about very much with chemical warfare. And there are those which literally absorbed on the skin can cause a very similar kind of fatal outcome with the same kind of symptoms. Now, the one thing that was a little bit more confusing about that is there was no evidence of any of that chemical in that immediate environmental area or the area where he was first exposed, which some of it should have basically fallen off, just the hands of the individuals. The second thing is that, to the best of our knowledge, those individuals who applied that to him didn't get seriously.
Right. They should have died on the spot, right?
Well, not necessarily. If they'd washed it off very quickly, one of them did apparently experience some symptoms of vomiting, and which would be consistent. So it's not completely exactly clear what it is, but there's no doubt it was a chemical that could be part of a chemical warfare kind of base. And so that one of the challenges we have today is knowing that there are these rogue states out there, like North Korea, that basically can and will continue to experiment with biologic and chemical weapons. And it's another one of the areas we talk about in Deadliest Enemies. What do we really need to know about that? What do we need to deal with that? And as much as I worry about the chemical agents, what is the nightmare scenario are certain biologic agents that could not only cover large areas and kill many, many thousands of people, but also in some cases with these infectious agents, they could then transmit out to others. And so once the, you might say, attack starts, it just continues to build on itself just through natural transmission.
And we're not seeing anything that some terrorist doesn't already know about. So I don't want people to think we're giving out some trade secrets here. But
right.
By dumping something in the water supply, wouldn't that be one of the most critical ways to wipe out a population?
Believe it or not, that's not.
Really?
That's a good thing. And, for example, you know, and this is why we surely, as you said, don't want to give the bad guys an idea. We actually have looked at certain kind of beverages and so forth where somebody could put something in at a pasteurization plant or where, you know, juices are manufactured.
Okay.
And there are some settings where we might have some concern. But chlorination in the water supply not only accomplishes killing the many of the biologic agents, but it also raises havoc with chemicals, and it actually denatures them in a way that they don't become the kind of hazard that we need to worry about. So I know that this is one that is a very commonly thought of avenue for attack, but it's really not one that's that likely to work. Just doing it through the air, though, however, and this is an example of what we cover in our book, Deadliest Enemies, is the concern about what we call dual-use research of concern, research that is very, very effective in doing good things for people, but it also can have a downside. I talked about this in my previous book, actually on this show, and at the time, people all panned it as fear-mongering, and then, of course, after the 9/11 anthrax cases occurred and people began really looking at this, they realized that what I had talked about could potentially happen, and that is, today, if you look at just agricultural crop sprayers, the way we deliver chemicals to kill mosquitoes, any number of things, it turns out that those very same techniques that we learn in ag school, it could very easily be used in a biologic setting to release a certain kinds of bacteria that could wreak havoc. Anthrax is a good example. They're using that same crop duster in the very same configuration that is used for a very good purpose, could be a very devastating purpose. And so those are the kind of things that we worry most about with biologic agents, is large area applications via the air of some infectious agents that could kill lots and lots of people.
With bioterrorism, must the individual who comes into contact with the agent do it directly, or do they then catch it from somebody else?
Well, if I'm understanding the question correctly, the individual who's working on this surely can protect themselves. Now, they may not be sophisticated enough to fully protect themselves and may actually die from, or at least get severely ill from the actual agent they're trying to transmit, mm-hmm. in okay. bacteria, or in some cases, viruses. But in general, you today, with some training, could surely pull this all off in a way that you yourself wouldn't be, you'd get sick from it.
Now, if he sneaks it, let's say, onto a plane, does everybody on that plane have to come in contact with this or breathe it in before they get infected?
You'd have to breathe in the air, and so they would have to get infected that way. Ironically, a plane may not always be the best way to do it, and so I'd tell anyone right now, don't even try to a plane, okay, because it turns out that the ventilation systems on planes are actually very complicated, and I've been involved with that as it relates for natural infections, where we've had, for example, somebody with highly drug-resistant tuberculosis flying on a plane from Europe to the United States, only to find out after they got here that that's what they had.
Wow.
And in that case, we've actually done air studies on planes, and here's an example of what I'm talking about. We had a 747 that an individual was in the upper floor, the cockpit area above on the plane, and coughed the whole way from Europe to the United States. They were coming to Minnesota for medical treatment.
How'd you like to be sitting next to that person?
Well, it turned out that wasn't the problem. The air actually quickly exhausted down the stairway, bounced down near the cabin where you go into the pilot's area, and literally started to concentrate about 15 to 20 rows back. And so it turned out that where you were physically didn't at all dictate what you were most likely to be exposed to.
Huh.
Even a better example I can give of you, and we talk about this in Deadliest Enemies, is again why certain agents are biologic, we call agents, are so effective, is an outbreak that I worked up in Minnesota at the Hubert Humphrey Metrodome a number of years ago when the Special Olympics were in town, and we had the International Special Olympics Games there. And on the opening night session, we had 65,000 people in that stadium, the Hubert Humphrey Metrodome. And all the participants came in via a kind of like a garage door out in right field, and they marched in by alphabet of country. And so, you know, the A's went in first, et cetera. Well, it turned out that as they marched around to home plate, left field, center field, and then the A's kind of sat right by home plate, and then they filled in the entire bottom field, the baseball field area of the Metrodome. That night, a young boy who was a participant from Argentina was just breaking with measles, the virus infection we just talked about. And it turned out that we had widespread transmission throughout the Special Olympics Games. About 2 weeks later, the incubation period, a number of people came down with measles who hadn't been adequately vaccinated. And we also had a group of cases in Minnesota citizens whose only contact with the Special Olympics event that lasted almost 10 days was that opening night session. And when we plotted where all of them sat, they sat in the far right field bleacher area, where back in the days when Mark McGwire was on steroids, he couldn't hit a home run. And when we did the air studies, it turned out that the air came out from behind home plate, kind of across home plate, mm-hmm. and the exhaust area fans for that air was way back at 480 to 500 feet back up in the upper right field bleachers, right exactly where those people sat.
How about that?
That virus literally jumped up over all those other people and deposited up there is where the air was moving.
That's incredible. Michael, we're going to talk more about this and take phone calls next on Coast to Coast AM.